Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network. Hello, I'm Laura Landon for the Journalism Channel. Today, we'll be talking about the crisis in American journalism with Victor Picard. He's the author of a recent book that maintains journalism is essential to democracy, yet Americans aren't getting the journalism they need. The book's title poses its central question, Democracy Without Journalism? And its subtitle is a call to action, Confronting the Misinformation Society. Victor Picard writes that what he terms toxic commercialism is at the heart of the rot in the American news system. In their drive for profits based on ad revenues, traditional newsrooms increasingly produce sensational clickbait, while social media giants like Facebook and Google spread outright lies and misinformation to keep their audiences enraged and engaged. Picard's book argues that the rise of Donald Trump illustrates core media failures, ones worsened by the steady decline in the numbers of journalists covering the news. The book says this crisis is not new and that citizen blogging or internet paywalls won't fix it. Only news reporting, financed by public money, not advertising, can save both American journalism and American democracy. Victor Picard is the author of several previous books, including Net Neutrality, A New Deal for the Digital Age, and America's Battle for Media Democracy. He's professor of media policy and political economy at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. And that's where we reached him. Our interview was conducted by Canadian journalist Bruce Wark.
You've written extensively about the American news media system and compared it to journalism in other countries. I'm wondering what led you to become interested in U.S. media and the way they present the news.
Well, probably first and foremost, the reason why I became so interested in the American news media is the simple fact that I'm immersed in that system. Although I am a quarter Canadian by heritage, I'm born and raised in the United States, and I have always been struck, at least since I began my graduate studies, by some of the particularities of the U.S. media system and how there are these recurring patterns in terms of how stories get covered, what's typically omitted or selected or emphasized in news narratives. And once you become interested, once you develop a kind of critical analysis of news media, it's not long before you try to look behind the curtain, as it were, to try to get at some of the structural underpinnings that typically lead to a particular kind of news coverage.
Now, near the beginning of your book, Democracy Without Journalism, Confronting the Misinformation Society, you refer to Donald Trump's rise and his unexpected election as president. You write that, and I'm quoting from your book here, three core media failures helped enable Trump's election. So let's look at these three core media failures in turn. What would you say was the first one?
Well, the first one that was most visible with Donald Trump's ascendance was simply the constant coverage in our news media, particularly cable or rather television news coverage. But I'm very clear to show in the beginning of my book, as you mentioned, that this coverage was symptomatic of deeper structural pathologies in the American news media system. So in other words, Trump was not the primary cause, but rather symptomatic, a symptom of these deeper maladies. And what I try to show is that there was this extreme commercial logic that was driving the news coverage that gave Trump constant coverage in our news media, billions of dollars worth of free media attention. And much of this it can be attributed to these typical news routines that are so present in the American news media system, false equivalents, trivializing and sensationalizing important issues in the media, this kind of horse race coverage where you're focused on, you know, what are the polls telling us now? What candidate is up or down? What outrageous thing did one candidate say about another? There's a focus on, you know, what were they wearing, especially in the 2016 elections. There was this focus on, for example, what clothes, you know, what was the fashion that Hillary Clinton was showcasing. So, of course, this coverage was also gendered in many ways. But it really goes back to these commercial imperatives that privilege particular values over others. Less movies, you might recall, infamously said, you know, this coverage might not be good for America, but it's damn good for CBS. Less movies, of course, being the former, now disgraced CEO of CBS. So I think that just speaks volumes as to the kinds of values that the American media system really triumph, the imperatives. I always say this commercialism trumps democracy, to use a terrible pun. So I think that first failure was very much visible, although I would argue, is again, it's a symptom, not the underlying cause.
Victor, you mentioned Les Moonves, the chairman and chief executive officer of CBS, and I happen to have a clip of him lined up here. So let's listen to Les Moonves on the coverage of Trump on CBS.
Man, who would have expected the ride we're all having right now? This is pretty amazing, and, you know, who would have thought that this circus would come to town? But, you know, it may not be good for America, but it's damn good for CBS. That's all I got to say. So, what can I say? It's you know, the money's rolling in, and this is,
the polls are open.
This is fun. We had a debate a couple of weeks ago with 14 million people on a Saturday night. You know, it's amazing. That's all I can say. It is. I've never seen anything like this, and you know, this is going to be a very good year for us. Sorry, it's a terrible thing to say, but bring it on, Donald. Go ahead. Keep going.
So that was CBS, the former CBS CEO, Les Moonves, at the Morgan Stanley Technology, Medium, and Telecom Conference in San Francisco during the presidential campaign in 2016. And it may be good for CBS, but you're arguing in your book that the commercial imperative is not so great for America.
That's right. I mean, much of this coverage is great for media business, you might say, but it's not good for democratic society. And, you know, I should be clear that these tendencies are particularly pronounced in the U.S. for various structural reasons that I'm sure we'll get into momentarily. But I would argue that in any commercial media system around the world, you're going to see similar patterns. And that's why, you know, when I focus on the journalism crisis in particular, it's not just an American journalism crisis. Increasingly, it's clear that it's a global journalism crisis. So I think we can look at the U.S. system as kind of a case study or a cautionary tale of what goes wrong when you let commercial values overwhelm the democratic imperatives of a news media system.
Now, we've been talking about what you see as the three core media failures that led to Trump's election. We have the first one, commercialism, excessive commercialism. What about the second core media failure that led to Trump? What was that?
So beyond these rampant commercial imperatives driving television news media, I would argue that, in fact, it's still the same commercial values, though manifest in a different way, particularly in our social media. So the tremendous amounts of misinformation, or really that's a catch-all for disinformation or just low-quality information that was circulating through our social media and also gained a lot of attention, I think, especially following the 2016 elections in the U.S., this is another core failure. And, you know, all this growing concern around the role of Facebook and to a lesser degree, Google and some of the other platform monopolies and the tremendous power they hold over our news and information systems. I think this is all bound up in this, again, commercial values overwhelming what should be seen as a core news and information infrastructure.
Right. The more clicks they get, the longer they keep you on Facebook, the more money they make from advertising.
That's absolutely right. And, you know, before perhaps the phrase was, if it bleeds, it leads. Now it's, if it's outrageous, it's contagious. And they want it to be contagious. The more that we engage with content that flows through their news feeds in Facebook and Twitter, the more advertising they sell, or more importantly, the more information they gather from us, because they're constantly surveilling us, that they then in turn sell to advertisers and data brokers. So this is a very troubling system. This is not the way a democratic society ideally would design their core news and information systems, but this is exactly what we're faced with, and we're increasingly seeing all the what economists might refer to as negative externalities, or the social harms that are bred from this economic relationship. And it's something that we need to rein in, I argue, throughout the book. And I have some ideas about that. But most immediately, I think we need to just draw attention to these structural causes. It's not, you know, we're so much struck by the symptoms and the surface level effects, but I constantly try to draw people to look under the hood, to try, you know, whatever metaphor we want to use, to try to see strike at the core roots of these problems. That's my major goal with writing this book.
And of course, Trump himself was an expert at using social media in his campaign, you know, a whole new art that he was practicing there.
That's exactly right. And as much as he benefited from mainstream coverage, and I always want to make sure that we don't let them off the hook. I mean, there was studies showing that even among our elite media, for example, the New York Times, there was almost no substantive coverage of actual policy differences between the candidates. But then if you go beyond mainstream media coverage and just look at how Trump was able to exploit social media, it takes it to a whole new level. He's able to circumvent what little scrutiny he might receive by speaking directly to audiences and to basically not be held to account in any meaningful way. In other words, he's able to lie outrageously. And those lies are further amplified through social media.
So what was the third core media failure that you say, you argue, led to Trump's election?
Right. And I guess I would soften it a little bit and say that, you know, these failures perhaps didn't directly lead, but they created the conditions that made it more easily done, so that Trump was able to ascend politically when he was promoting a very dangerous politics that really should have never seen the light of day. But this third core failure that I focus on is really the main subject of the book, which is what I refer to, and I mentioned earlier, the journalism crisis, and that is the collapse of actual journalism, actual original news reporting that we're seeing again in the U.S., but increasingly around the world, where financially there's really no longer a model to sustain. Arguably, there never was a model, a commercial model to begin with, but especially today we're seeing this spectacular collapse of any kind of model that can support the journalism that democratic societies require.
Yeah, I look at the New York Times, the Washington Post, the big media, they seem to be doing okay. But you talk about news deserts in the U.S. What do you mean by that?
Right, so news desert is this very apt metaphor that's increasingly prevalent in our discourse around journalism, around democracy, where you have entire regions and communities that lack any access to local news media whatsoever. So really the news desert problem gets at the heart of the journalism crisis, which is the complete disappearance of local journalism. And local journalism, as we all learn in school, is the hallmark of democratic society. We all learn that without a free and, by implication, functional press, democracy, self-governance is rendered impossible. So if we lose local journalism, we really do, in effect, lose democracy. And that's the core problem that I'm trying to draw attention to. Again, the economic structural roots of that crisis and what we need to work our ways out of this problem.
You have a telling phrase in your book that, as a journalist myself, I found a bit frightening. It's the hamsterization of journalism. What do you mean by that?
I stole that phrase from earlier critics, but I think that that basically is an emphasis on exploiting journalistic labor. So journalists are expected to do more for less. And this, of course, naturally arises from the fact that there are just fewer journalists. What journalists are there are expected to take on what previously had been done by, small armies of journalists. Or there's also an increasing reliance on freelance labor, even volunteer labor. So this, again, is symptomatic of these deeper economic problems, which is there's just not enough revenue. There's not enough financial support to sustain the kind of reporting that any democratic society requires. And this is especially clear when we look at what's happening around the kind of journalism that's often not the these aren't the sexiest stories, but just, for example, reporting on the local school board or city hall or what's happening at the state level or the regional level, what's happening in state governments, for example. Those kind of journalists, that kind of reporting has almost entirely disappeared. And that's the kind of reporting that doesn't typically sell advertising. It doesn't serve as clickbait, but it's exactly that kind of journalism that democracy requires, and it's that kind of journalism that's rapidly disappearing.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I just want to underline the job losses in journalism. I've got a clip here, Victor, from Amy Goodman, Democracy Now!, May 19th, 2020, and she's just talking about job losses just since March, with the advent of the COVID-19 crisis. Here's Amy Goodman.
At a time when many journalists are risking their lives to cover one of the most significant stories of their lifetime, media companies are slashing jobs and salaries. Over the past week, hundreds of journalists at Vice, Quartz, The Economist, BuzzFeed, Condé Nast have been laid off. In April, The New York Times estimated 36,000 employees of news media companies had been laid off, furloughed, or had their pay reduced since the arrival of the pandemic. 36,000, and that was a month ago.
That's Amy Goodman in May on job losses in journalism. She went on to say that the crisis in journalism is not new. She quoted the Pew Research Center saying that U.S. newspapers have shed about half of their newsroom staff since 2008. That's quite a number there, half of their staff. So, and it's similar in Canada as well. We're facing the same crisis here. But in some ways, it's not as bad as in the U.S. Victor, you imagine someone trying to describe the U.S. media system to a visitor from another dimension. Let's say I'm that visitor from another dimension. How would you describe it to me?
Right. So if you were coming from this other dimension and looked at the American media system, you would note that much of this system is dominated by a handful of corporations. To call them oligopolies in many cases is overly generous. Oftentimes we're really talking about duopolies or even monopolies that have tremendous control over vast swaths of the American media system. Beyond that, you would notice that these corporations are only lightly regulated, if at all. There are very few public interest regulations. Someone might tell you that there was a time when we had stronger public interest protections in the U.S., such as the Fairness Doctrine, but that was jettisoned in 1987. But I think the most important feature that you would note in the American media system that we've already been hinting at throughout this conversation is the extreme commercialism. The American media system is overwhelmingly dominated by these commercial imperatives, and there are only weak public alternatives. We have a public, for example, our public broadcasting system, which many people hold in high regard. But if you compare that to other democratic countries around the world, we are almost literally off the chart. I have a chart in my book that shows this. For how much money we pay per person per year towards our public media, it comes out to about $1.40 per person at the federal level. If you throw in local and regional subsidies, you might get it up to about $3.40. Where comparing that to Western and Northern European countries, for example, the BBC receives about $100 per person per year. If you look at some of the Nordic countries, you may get up to somewhere around $200 per person per year. So what this means is that we in the United States are left with a very impoverished social safety net for when the market fails to support the level of journalism that democratic society needs. And that's exactly the problem I'm trying to draw attention to. And beyond that, beyond using this kind of thought exercise of how you would try to explain this system to someone for whom it's not a natural system, I'm drawing attention to the fact that this is not what a democratic society would typically desire. You know, this is not a natural or inevitable system. It's something that was historically contingent, that developed because particular interests won out over others. And throughout my work, I often point to these earlier policy battles that led us to inherit this weird system in the U.S. But all this is an attempt to denaturalize it. I think that's the first step towards changing it.
Now, you did mention the Fairness Doctrine that was done away with in 1987. What was the Fairness Doctrine, and why was it important?
Well, the Fairness Doctrine is often held up as the high watermark for enlightened policymaking, media policymaking in the U.S. And I try to problematize those assumptions because actually, if you trace it back to the 1940s when the Fairness Doctrine was first established, you'll see that it actually, in many ways, was a consolation prize to media reformers who were actually advocating for even more aggressive structural reforms. Now, first, what is it? Many people think, often conflate the Fairness Doctrine with the equal time rule, which is this idea that, you know, two sides, both political sides, oftentimes presumed to be, you know, one Democrat, one Republican, get equal time in our media. But that's not what the Fairness Doctrine was meant to do. Rather, it was meant to mandate broadcasters for them to hold on to their monopolistic use, their license to the public airwaves. They must cover important and even controversial issues that local communities wanted to hear or see on their local public airwaves, and then to do so in a balanced manner. So there really was this kind of affirmative duty that media owners, that broadcasters in particular, had to cover these issues, and not just two sides, but a multiplicity, a plurality of viewpoints, to really try to broaden the spectrum of political debate in the U.S. Now, I won't leave our listeners, in suspense. Of course, this was never a perfect reform to begin with, but it did maintain some level of accountability. It did provide activists or just concerned citizens with a tool to try to discipline their local broadcasters to cover important issues. But it never quite lived up to that. And then it was thrown out during the Reagan administration in the 1980s.
Now, Victor Picard, it does seem obvious, as you mention, and as you stress in your book, that the current crisis in American journalism is really related to a collapse in advertising revenue that for 150 years or so has been the main source of mainstream media revenues and profits. Yet, you write in your book that commercial journalism has always been in crisis. No golden age to look back to. Why do you say that?
I'm glad you asked that question because people who listen to me speak and don't actually read my book sometimes mistakenly assume or project onto what I'm saying that there was some kind of golden age, some sort of mythological golden era of American journalism. And I'm very clear that I'm not arguing that. I don't think there was ever a great moment. I mean, certainly, I think we could say that things have gotten worse. And there may have been earlier moments. People often point to the 1970s during the era of Watergate and the Pentagon Papers, that there used to be more robust investigative journalism. That arguably might be true, but we have to be clear that since the dawn of commercialization and really throughout the entire history of the American press, it has never served all communities particularly well, especially communities of color and lower socioeconomic communities. So I want to really disabuse people of this notion that we once had a great press and we just need to go back to that moment. Beyond that, I'm also trying to show, because I'm drawing attention to these structural factors, I want to show that many of these problems were baked into the commercial model, into the very DNA of the American press system since the moment it first commercialized. And as you know, that means when it first became reliant on advertising revenue. And the U.S. is different, although the Canadian press is very similar in this regard as well. But most newspaper industries around the world aren't as reliant on advertising revenue. In the U.S., it often broke down to about 80% to 20%. So 80% of their revenues derived from advertising revenue and 20% derived from various kinds of reader support, such as subscriptions or newsstand sales. And now as we've seen that advertising model collapse, that really has spelled the doom of the core business model for American journalism. And just to add a few more details to that, what we're really talking about, and there's often this lazy narrative that it's the internet that killed journalism. That's not true. It's this over-reliance on advertising. And so that when advertisers and readers migrated to the web and you saw digital advertising revenue pay pennies to the dollar of traditional advertising revenue, that's what led to this collapse of the core business model. And that's really the sort of the crux of the economic crisis for journalism. But these structural problems were always there. And that's why I say American journalism has always been prone to crisis.
You're listening to a New Books Network interview with Victor Picard, author of Democracy Without Journalism, Confronting the Misinformation Society. The interviewer is Canadian journalist Bruce Wark.
You talk about the deep historical roots of the present crisis in American journalism, and how would you summarize that history briefly?
Right. So as I noted, ever since you had this reliance on advertising revenue, it encouraged particular tendencies in press coverage. It encouraged or incentivized publishers to really emphasize sensationalistic covering. We had this term from the late 1800s, early 1900s, yellow journalism, which is really was, you know, what we refer to as clickbait today, or maybe, although we can't really use this term anymore, but fake news. But just we can't use that term because, of course, Donald Trump has basically co-opted it. But this idea that because the highest premium was placed on profit, on how can we turn a profit. It wasn't concerned about how do we inform citizens. It treated audiences as consumers, as passive consumers, not engaged citizens. So that meant whatever we could do to attract their attention, just as Facebook is doing this today, the publishers, the newspaper publishers of the early 1900s, we're most concerned about capturing our attention and delivering it to advertisers. And advertisers were never really that worried about supporting local journalism or investigative reporting. They were trying to gain access to audiences. The best way to do that was to go to the local newspaper, which typically had a local monopoly over that given market. So this was this relationship of convenience, a marriage of convenience and necessity. It wasn't about informing people. It wasn't about enriching democracy in any meaningful way. When it did, and it certainly did do that at times, that was really more of a byproduct of this economic relationship between advertisers and publishers and media owners. Once that relationship was no longer convenient, once advertisers were able to find a better deal online, then they jumped ship. And that's what's left us today. Journalism was always a public good. It was never meant to be a commodity, but that relationship was camouflaged by the fact that it was so profitable for so many years, and that relationship had become naturalized. Now we realize that advertisers, which really provided a kind of subsidy for the journalism we needed, are no longer there to support it, and we have to find some other means to do so.
I have to say, Victor, having read your book, that there's a real sense of urgency in it. You write that journalism is just as important as public education, libraries, and parks. A viable press system is not a luxury, it is a necessity. And yet you also write that key policymakers in the States, the politicians and the policy wonks and so on, are not really doing anything about the present crisis. Why is that, if journalism is so vital?
I'm glad you asked this question, because that's the question I'm really grappling with in my book. Why has there been almost no policy response whatsoever to what should be seen as a national and even international crisis? And again, I think it goes back to this point that journalism, or at least the information produced by journalism, should be seen as a public good. Public goods are not provided or not supported by the market in terms of quantity and quality. It is something that you typically have to find non-market means of support. And I think public education is another great example. Public parks, libraries, even the military is something that typically we would not leave subjected to be entirely supported by market relationships. Now, there's a technical economic term Also, a public good is non-rivalrous and non-excludable. This means that it's very difficult to prevent free riders. In other words, it's very difficult to monetize. It's also very difficult to create barriers around. So, it's very hard, again, to treat it as something that individuals will pay for. It's something that societies need to provide for. And throughout history, we saw moments where there was this public recognition that the market was doing great violence to journalism. In my book, I point to earlier moments in the early 1900s when there were these public reactions to the kinds of yellow journalism that I mentioned earlier. There was also the Hutchins Commission, the Kerner Commission. It's like every few decades, there's this kind of reckoning, but we're constantly kicking the can down the road, never really dealing with the structural roots of the problems, and therefore it only reemerges again and again. And unfortunately, this time, I think the crisis is quite existential, so we really do have to figure it out.
Yes. In your book, you see the present crisis in American journalism as an opportunity to democratize the media system. But at the same time, I notice that you're skeptical about the potential for reviving the present system with things like that have often been touted, like, say, citizen journalism, news financed by subscriptions and paywalls. In fact, you write that the present system can't be revived. Why do you say that?
That's right. I think the evidence is overwhelmingly clear at this point. It's been clear for some time, but I think even now we're finally seeing some consensus emerge, which is that there is no commercial option. There's no commercial future for many kinds of journalism, especially those kinds of journalism that we keep talking about, like local journalism in particular. The market will not solve this problem. So we really have to look outside the market to try to find a way to support the journalism we need. And I go through the book and look, you know, discuss the various studies and the empirical evidence that supports this conclusion. And we see that not only has the advertising revenue entirely collapsed irreparably, but also we can't depend on paywalls, on individual subscribers to pay enough. Again, going back to this idea of the public good nature of journalism, and it's something that we can't expect individuals to pay enough towards. They're either unwilling or unable to pay enough money. Now, this is true for, I would argue, almost all newspapers or news outlets. The great exceptions, as we mentioned earlier, are the big three in the U.S., the Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, and New York Times. But beyond those big national papers and perhaps some small niche outlets, most newspapers cannot be sustained by reader support, by individual subscribers. So then we have to look at the two models that I look at most extensively would be the nonprofit model, where we can look to rich benefactors or foundations and various kinds of philanthropic and charitable institutions to support journalism or to at least contribute towards journalism. We might have hybrid models as well, where it might be part commercial and part nonprofit. And I think there are many exciting exemplars that we can point to in this regard. But I'm also very clear that also is not a systemic fix. That might save a newspaper here and there or create a new outlet here and there, but that's not going to provide the kind of systemic fix that we need. And that's why, in the end, I place so much emphasis on a public media option for the future of journalism.
And what would a public media option look like?
So I think there are many important details that need to be worked out, especially at the local level. And that's why I'm hesitant to be overly prescriptive in my analysis, because I think in the end, local communities need to make these decisions for themselves. But I think at the very least, federal governments should have an affirmative duty to provide the necessary resources. And that's why I call for a massive public media trust fund to support the kind of journalism, to go into the news deserts, to make sure that all people, all members of society, all communities have access to the news and information that they need. But beyond that, I think that this must be devolved in terms of ownership and control to the state and local levels. There needs to be multiple layers of citizen bureaus that are representative of the broader society. And also that journalists themselves should own and control their newsrooms. So I'm really seeing not just, I think the first step is to try to remove journalism as much as possible from the market, to first decommercialize or decommodify it. But the second step is that we must radically democratize it. It must be not just public in name, but actually publicly owned and controlled. And that's really my key conclusion in my book, to really focus on reimagining what journalism could and should be and entirely restructure it from the ground up.
Yes, I'd like to explore that a little bit, the restructuring, giving journalists more say over what they do, giving local communities more say over what they get reported to them. How do you see that happening? Like, what would the structures be like?
Well, I think there are a number of ways of doing this. And, you know, the first step, of course, is to guarantee the resources. And there's always a reaction to that. You know, how do we pay for this? And I think the ideal scenario would be to simply take that money straight out of the treasury, to treat this as something as important as as public education or national defense, these core infrastructures and systems, that we would not sit there and say, you know, how are you going to pay for that? It's just a necessity. It's not a luxury. But beyond that, we also could look at ways, for example, everything from taxing the platform monopolies, which I failed to mention earlier. I mean, what digital advertising revenue is being generated is almost entirely going to the big bad duopoly of Facebook and Google. So this idea that they should allocate a small percentage of their sizable profits towards a public media system, towards a public media fund, is something that I've argued for in various places. And also, we could repurpose already existing public infrastructures and media subsidies. When Americans hear this phrase, media subsidy, they fall into a fetal position. But if we know our history, media subsidies are as American as apple pie. They go back to the postal system. The government's always involved, always subsidizing our media system. It's just a question of how they should do that. And we also could be repurposing international broadcasting subsidies. I even argue for using the postal system as a new kind of news delivery infrastructure, and even to convert post offices into community media centers. So there are many different ways we can do this, many ideas out there. It's just a failure of political will. But after we decide how we're going to support it in terms of resources and providing the necessary public space for news production, we have to guarantee that it remains democratized, that it remains independent. And Americans are often very fearful that any sort of publicly subsidized media system is a slippery slope towards totalitarianism. And we can point to thriving democratic societies around the world where that clearly is not true. In fact, strong public media systems often correlate with strong democracies. So other democratic societies have figured this out. I think we can in the United States as well. And again, as I mentioned earlier, many ways of doing this, but I think it really stems from this idea of local control, of setting up news bureaus or to have constant dialogue. And studies are now showing, really not surprising at all, that when news outlets are in constant dialogue, when there's constant engagement with local citizens, there's higher levels of public trust. And that gets to the third question, oftentimes, that people throw up. When I talk about this new kind of public media system, once we build it, how can we guarantee that people will actually come to it, trust it, use it? And I think if local citizens are directly engaged with every level of news production and governance, they're going to they're going to trust that news media system. And we already have some evidence that shows that this is true. So those are just some basic parameters. But I also argue that journalists themselves need to be very much in control of their own newsrooms. They need to, for example, one idea is that they should elect their own editors, that they're actually engaged in ownership and governance of their own newsrooms. This also means they should be unionized. And this means that the newsrooms should look like the communities that they serve. So really, this whole division between journalists and local communities needs to be broken down.
Now, Victor Picard, I want to end with a look at journalism itself, not the kind of journalism you're criticizing here, but the kind you envision in a new system which would benefit from large public subsidies. I think from the Treasury, you mentioned the figure of $30 billion a year as a cornerstone of public finance for media, for news media, and all of the additional sources of revenue you mentioned as well. But you also paint a picture, quite a compelling one, if I can say that, of the kind of journalism, and I'm just going to quote here, journalism that privileges democracy over profits, that goes to where the silences are in society, an information system that keeps a laser-like focus on climate change, hyper-inequality, mass incarceration. That's a kind of a vision of a journalism that doesn't really exist now. And how likely do you think it is that we can get there?
That's an excellent question. And you're absolutely right. This is admittedly a utopian vision. But I guess I'm taking as my baseline point of departure is that we really don't have a choice. I mean, if we really want the kind of journalism that we need, we're going to have to radically restructure it, reimagine what's possible. And that really, in a nutshell, is what my entire book is dedicated to doing, is simply broadening our imagination about what is possible. And I think it's precisely during these dark political moments when we should put forward these bold ideas. And I think to look at, to basically try to think what this new kind of journalism would look like. In many ways, I'm simply saying, let journalists be journalists. This is why journalists went into the profession in the first place, is to speak truth to power, to give voice to the voiceless. And I think this is something that they would be liberated to do if we removed these commercial pressures, if we took journalism out of the market and allowed it to be the public good that it was always meant to be. So this is what I'm advocating for, and I do think it's quite possible. I think history is open-ended. So if we begin talking about it in terms of concrete possibilities, and if we look at already promising signs, there are already many new and exciting experiments both in the U.S. and around the world. I think we can really broaden our view of what's possible, of what journalism could and should be. And I'm weirdly optimistic that this can happen. I'm especially given hope by the fact that young people today are less enthralled to market fundamentalism. And I think it's on them to really try to rebuild our core systems and infrastructures and to make sure that they do actually serve democracy and not simply profits for a small number of rich white men.
Well, Victor Picard, I certainly enjoyed talking with you about your book, Democracy Without Journalism, Confronting the Misinformation Society. And it's one in a series of books and articles you've written on the news media in the U.S. Where do you go from here? What are you working on next?
Right. So many of the questions that we've been discussing throughout this conversation are actually leading me to the next book project, which is tentatively titled The Media We Need. And it's really trying to put some flesh on these bones of, you know, what would this new media system look like? How could we ensure that it is radically democratic, that it actually does serve the communities it's purportedly always meant to serve? And how can we guarantee that these newsrooms of the future actually look like those communities? So this book is really going to focus on questions such as, you know, kind of the nuts and bolts questions of, you know, what would these new kinds of journalism look like? What would these new routines look like? How would we set up these relationships between journalists and local communities? How would they be governed? How would they be financially supported? What's happened around the world and throughout history? So really just trying to add more examples and to continue contributing to this broader conversation that we all should be engaged in, which is how do we create a media system that actually serves democracy? And so this will be the core question of my next book.
Thank you so much for talking to me today, Victor. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Bruce. I've really enjoyed the conversation.
You've been listening to an interview with Victor Picard, Professor of Media Policy and Political Economy at the Annenberg School for Communication. His book is called Democracy Without Journalism: Confronting the Misinformation Society. The interviewer was Canadian journalist Bruce Wark. I'm Laura Landon. See you next time on the New Books Network.